Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming to the RSA today to hear what's going to be, I think, an absolutely fascinating presentation from Sam. My name's Lindsay Hanley. I'm a writer and a journalist and a huge admirer of the work carried out by Sam and Daniel Lorison, the researchers on this book, The Glass Ceiling. So we're joined today by Sam Friedman, co-author of The Glass Ceiling, to hear about why it pays to be privileged. Sam works at the LSE. He's an associate professor in sociology, and his research in particular focuses on the cultural dimensions of contemporary class divisions. So basically how we reproduce class divisions through, as he will discuss, elements of cultural capital, taste and distinction and so on. He's the author of several books. The Glass Ceiling came out at the beginning of the year, and it's had a fantastic amount of coverage and rightfully deserved. So Sam will talk about the book and his findings for about 20 minutes, and then us two will have a talk about it for about another 20 minutes, and then we'll get some questions from the audience. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for the invitation. It's really nice to be here. Now, you might be forgiven for forgetting. She certainly has. But Theresa May came to power in 2016 with an explicit commitment to put class inequality at the top of the policy agenda. Britain must become, and I quote her here, the greatest meritocracy. This, she said, is the primary means to address society's burning injustices. But is getting ahead in contemporary Britain really just a matter of merit? Well, over the last 5 years or so, myself and my colleague Daniel Lorison have been carrying out a project culminating in the book that we are presenting today that's aimed to answer precisely this question, specifically looking at how a person's class background affects their ability to get in, but also get on in Britain's most prized occupations. And the next 20 minutes or so, I just want to give you a very brief whistle-stop tour of the main findings and hopefully convince you that they matter. But perhaps the first question that you're thinking about is, how do we actually measure a person's class background? Well, the truth is there's no undisputed way, but here we are using perhaps the most established single indicator, which looks at a person's parental occupation when they were growing up. Based on answers to this, we then organise people's class origins into these three ONS socioeconomic classes. Okay, first, those whose parents did middle class, upper middle class, professional and managerial work. Second, those whose parents did lower middle class, intermediate or skilled manual work, shop owners, electricians, etc. And finally, those whose parents did solidly working class, routine jobs, cleaners, labourers, those who were long-term unemployed. And once we do this, we can then look, as we do here, at how these origins correspond to people's destinations in terms of the jobs they themselves then do. So this is our rather pretty, we think, but also rather depressing analysis of overall flows in the UK, drawing on here nationally representative data from over 100,000 people in Britain's largest employment survey, the Labour Force Survey. But you'll notice that our destination groups are slightly different, as we are particularly interested in those who reach these elite jobs in the upper right-hand corner. And here we're defining elite occupations as both higher and professional managerial jobs, lawyers, doctors, engineers. But we also add a set of cultural occupations, things like journalists and those working in film and the media, because these are as, if not more, competitive than most of our traditional professions. And they also wield really an outsized cultural influence on Britain. So we're particularly interested in these people here, I suppose. Those who get to the top against the odds, if you will. The 10% of those from working class backgrounds who reach elite destinations. But of course, and this is a key question for us, these elite jobs are not all the same. This shows you the social composition of each of Britain's sort of elite occupations in terms of those from these three origin groups that I just told you about. And what you can see here is real diversity from the exclusivity of medicine, where only 6% of doctors are from working class backgrounds, to actually the relative openness of professions like engineering, where perhaps the majority are actually not from middle or upper middle class backgrounds. Now, some of this skew can be explained by the advantages enjoyed by those who follow directly in their parents' footsteps. Some interesting stats for you here. If you have a parent who is a doctor, you are a somewhat staggering 24 times more likely to become a doctor yourself. And if you are a child of lawyers, you are 17 times more likely to go into law. Okay. But what happens once you're in these jobs? Who gets on? Well, the answer is that it quite literally pays to be privileged in contemporary Britain. Those from working class backgrounds within these elite jobs face a very significant class pay gap. This is about £6,500 a year, or 16% difference compared to those in the same jobs from privileged backgrounds. And significantly, this is particularly acute for women from working class backgrounds. They face a clear double disadvantage. As you can see here, they earn on average £19,000 a year less than men from privileged backgrounds in the same jobs. So we're not in any way arguing that the class ceiling is replacing the glass ceiling here. Very clear intersections. Also intersections for race and ethnicity and class. You can see a double disadvantage here for many socially mobile black and minority ethnic professionals. But of course, a simple distribution of averages can't tell us whether the mobile face a class ceiling, okay? In fact, you may have already started to formulate your own explanations for this, okay? Maybe working class people are simply younger on average than those from privileged backgrounds in elite occupations, and therefore they're less far along in their careers. Perhaps the privileged have higher rates of educational attainment. Maybe they just work harder or perform better at work. So to interrogate this, we conducted a series of regression analysis on the class pay gap, but controlling for a whole set of factors known from other work to affect earnings. And some of these explanations are indeed part of the story. Okay, education does explain some of the class pay gap. Those from privileged backgrounds tend to have higher qualifications. They tend to attend more prestigious universities, both of which are associated with higher earnings. Significantly, though, even Oxbridge, supposedly the ultimate sorting house of academic ability, does not wash away class origin. Graduates from privileged backgrounds from Oxford still go on to earn about £5,000 a year more than their working class colleagues. Other important mechanisms are also at work. The privileged are more likely to work in London. They're more likely to work in large firms, and they're more likely to work in certain occupations like finance, all of which, of course, are associated with higher pay. But most importantly, even when we adjust for all of these factors, along with demographics and a range of conventional indicators of merit, how many hours you work, your level of training, your level of experience, still half the class pay gap remains. This is worth underlining. Even when those from working class backgrounds are similar to their advantaged colleagues, in every way we can measure in Britain's largest employment survey, they still earn significantly less. So then the question is why? Getting at this black box of explanation is really what most of our book is devoted to, and something we felt really required going beyond survey data. What we brokered then was access to a number of elite firms. We went behind the closed doors of a large multinational accountancy firm, a successful architecture practice, and one of Britain's biggest television channels. We also wanted to look at working life outside of firms, so we spoke to self-employed actors. Now, these case studies involved a lot of field work, some observation of interviews, promotion panels, etc., but pivoted mainly around 175 interviews with employees from different backgrounds and at different grades. In each case, we began with a kind of x-ray of the firm, okay? How did the firm look in terms of the class composition of its staff? And this was really quite revealing. It showed us that the class pay gap, unlike the gender pay gap, is not necessarily an issue of equal pay for equal work, but more about what we might call the sorting of the socially mobile. Horizontally into less prestigious and less well-paying departments, and most importantly, vertically into lower tiers or positions. Now, just to give you one example of this, this is our TV channel, who I can actually name here. We don't in the book, but this is our case study, who de-anonymized themselves by actually very bravely publishing the research we did with them, Channel 4. And you can see why I say bravely here. This is a very acute class ceiling at Channel 4. Those from working class backgrounds are not only hugely underrepresented in the first place, but they drop off sharply as you look upwards at the top ranks. And of course, one of the things driving this is departmental sorting within the channel. As you can see here, by far the most exclusive area is commissioning. Not only the creative hub and probably the most prestigious area, but also the area that has the most sort of senior management roles. So how do we account for this kind of ceiling effect? Obviously, I don't have time to take you through the entire book, but I just want to briefly pull out four drivers that emerged from across the case studies. And what I want to do is narrate these drivers through the lens of one interviewee in particular. This interviewee was Mark. Mark was a senior commissioner at Channel 4. This is, of course, not his real name. Mark was from a fairly privileged background, okay? His parents were successful professionals. He had been educated at one of the country's top private schools and then at Oxford. Now, Mark undoubtedly had one of the most coveted jobs in television. He controlled a budget extending to the millions, and every day a steady stream of independent television producers arrived at his desk, desperate to land a pitch. At 39, he was very young to wield such power. Certainly, he'd enjoyed a swift ascension. But when we met Mark on the top floor of Channel 4's futuristic aluminium and glass-clad headquarters and invited him to narrate his career in his own words, interestingly, a very different account emerged. He acknowledged, of course, that he has certain objective merits, prestigious educational credentials, a strong work ethic, even certain skills. He talked about having an eye for narrative, for example, or a knack for what he called idea generation. But the most crucial thing he told us was that his talents were given a platform, a chance to develop, as he put it, or later, an opportunity to shine. And central in applying or supplying this platform, he says, were his parents, who for over 5 years had provided a financial safety net that had tided him over when he was jockeying around for his first permanent contract as a TV producer. Indeed, this kind of early career investment from the bank of mum and dad was echoed across our interviews, particularly among those in the culture and creative industries, and particularly among those from privileged backgrounds. This kind of financial cushion, we found, acts as a pivotal form of insulation from the uncertainty associated with forging a career in these areas, both in terms of negotiating the cost of living in London, where most of the opportunities are clustered, but also more psychologically, in terms of engendering a sense that one can take more risks, spend more time on networking, take more uncertain or short-term roles, all of which have long-term payoffs for people's careers. In contrast, those who lacked family money described the day-to-day reality of making a living in these areas as a kind of economic chaos, or as actor Ray aptly put it here, like skydiving without a parachute. But it's not just about money. More significant for Mark's accelerated trajectory, for example, were a handful of senior colleagues who he explained had taken him under their wing and, this is crucial, often operating beneath formal mechanisms, had facilitated jobs or advocated on his behalf. Now, this type of sponsorship was actually particularly common in our accountancy firm. Most partners talked openly about this notion of bringing through younger staff to partners. And while, of course, this was presented as a process of talent spotting, what we found was that sponsor relationships were actually rarely established initially on the basis of work performance. Instead, they were almost always forged, in the first instance at least, on a sort of sense of cultural affinity, on a sense that you feel familiar with someone, that you recognize, as you can see from this quote here. And as senior managers across our case studies, as I showed you, are themselves overwhelmingly from privileged background, this idea of sponsoring in one's own image then acts as a further mechanism for perpetuating the class ceiling. Back to Mark. Perhaps most pivotal to his extent, he went on to tell us, was an ability to, in his words, fit in with the telly tribe, okay? Particularly at the upper echelons of television commissioning. Vital here, he noted, was a sense of how to perform in certain work environments, making an explicit link between what he called the rules of the game and the specificities of his class background. Let me give you an example, he said, recalling a period on the senior production team of a news programme. So every day we had this morning meeting where we decided what stories to do, and everyone pitched in on what our angle should be, and it was instantly recognisable to me, just like the common rooms I encountered at Oxford and at school. The rules were, it's good to be right, it's better to be funny. Now, these curious and fairly opaque behavioural codes were reiterated across our interviews at Channel 4, constituting a powerful sense of what we call studied informality. There were two key dimensions of this. First, a particular package of self-presentation, an RP accent, casual but hip dress. There was a lot of discussion about the right kind of trainers to wear at Channel 4. A knowing, often ironic humour. Who knows when to swear in meetings, when to put their feet up, when to mop their managers. And a level of interpersonal familiarity, hugs and kisses rather than handshakes, not normally associated with the professional workplace. Second, it also involved a particular intellectual or highbrow way of actually talking about television, particularly in commissioning, where there was this sense of needing to drop cultural references from other high art forms or speak in an arcane or lyrical tone about television, even when many, like this interviewee here, told us that these kinds of references were actually completely irrelevant to the kinds of mainstream programmes being made at the channel. Why are we talking about the great American novel in relation to a programme about lie detectors, Deb says here. And unsurprisingly, it was those from working class backgrounds who found these codes particularly alienating, intimidating, who struggled to master studied informality, who, in the words of Claire here, constantly feel like they're imposters, like everyone else intimately knows each other, even if in reality they know they can't or they don't. Now, these kind of behavioural codes may seem superficial, but we would argue, and do across two chapters in the book, that they're in many ways the most important single driver of the class ceiling. Why? Well, we tend to think about merit at work as having a sort of fixed nature, that most indicators are objectively measurable and equally recognised by all. But a key theme running through our book is that supposedly objective measures of merit are often actually assessed very differently according to how they're performed. Some performances fit, in other words, and others do not. And in many professions, this is about the historical legacy of an overwhelmingly privileged white male majority who have been able to embed, even institutionalise, their own ideas about the right way to work in the workplace, their own behavioural codes, if you will, that in turn continue to shape perceptions within those firms of who it is that's appropriate to promote and progress. This is largely expressed and was to us in interviews as a kind of gut feeling, an intuitive sense, as one Turner Clark partner put it to us, that some people just feel like a partner. And our main point here is that in most cases, these behavioural codes are actually fairly arbitrary. Okay? They certainly can't be reliably pegged to any credible measure of work performance, ability, or intelligence. And further, we think they tend to be particularly important in certain elite work environments. So here we're talking about, as I mentioned, commissioning in television, but we also found this similarly in advisory and accountancy, where performance is especially hard to evaluate and where notions of merit are therefore particularly uncertain and contestable. In these environments, the success of the final product is actually very hard to foretell. And therefore, the knowledge and expertise of the professional is inherently ambiguous. Presenting or performing the right image, then, when advising a client or pitching a television programme, becomes integral as an act of persuasion, a proxy for a competence that can't be reliably or definitively demonstrated in the moment. Now, thus far, we've interrogated various barriers that hold the upwardly mobile back. But what about their actions, their aspirations, their decisions? Here we did find some evidence that the upwardly mobile commit acts of what we called self-elimination in elite occupations. This manifested in various ways, but one theme that came up a lot was among those who had actually done fairly well. They'd got close to the top, but once in the kind of executive setting, had found themselves unwilling or unable to play by the rules, okay, or push for the very top. This is Bill. Bill was a commissioner from a working class background at Channel 4, and he provided a really telling example. He explained that as his career developed, and particularly in the pursuit of becoming a commissioner, he'd engaged in a fairly intricate process of cultural mimicry. He'd changed his accent. He'd decided never to talk about his background at work. He generally imitated the highbrow culture I outlined earlier. But as he explains in this really lucid quote, reaching the very top in television is often contingent on assimilation, not just in your professional life, but also in your personal life. of fully embracing the kind of clubbable aspects of the profession. But for Bill, extending this performance into his social life is basically a step too far, one that requires a kind of existential betrayal of everything that he describes here as real and important to him. In this way, Bill, like many we spoke to, really underlined the limits of class cultural assimilation, a theme that I think comes out really beautifully, actually, in Lindsay's book, Respectable. Finally, I just want to finish with this quote from Mark. "It's not like I think I'm rubbish," he says here. "I mean, I've seen lots of peers with greater networks and privilege screw up because they just weren't good enough. But at the same time, it's mad to pretend that there's not been an incredibly strong following wind throughout my career." So this idea of a following wind, a gust of privilege, if you will, really gets to the heart of what our book is about. It neatly captures, we think, the kind of subtle propulsive power provided by an advantaged background, how it acts as an energy-saving device that allows some to get further with less effort, deftly shaping career trajectories, delineating what courses of action are available, what kind of support is possible, and how one's merits, crucially, are perceived by others, particularly gatekeepers. Equally, the metaphor visualizes the experience of the upwardly mobile, who very often in our experience feel like they have the wind against them. It's not that these individuals can't move forward, it's not that they never reach the top, just that generally it takes longer, happens less frequently, and often represents a markedly more labor-intensive, even emotionally exhausting experience. And our main point to leave you with is that when the following wind of privilege is misread as merit, then the inequalities that result are legitimized. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam. That was a brilliant concise summation of the findings of your book. I really wanted to know, actually, having conducted that research and having conducted a set of intensive interviews with people from a range of backgrounds and working in a range of elite occupations, did you set out with some assumptions about the rigidity of class that were then upended, or did it actually confirm a lot of the sense that you had, that there was something going on behind the apparent reality of class that was revealed in the emotional content of the interviews?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think, you know, the context for this specific qualitative work was, I suppose, a set of findings that had already come out of this large-scale quantitative work. So we already, I suppose, in that way, had a sense that there was something going on.
Yeah.
But in each case, I suppose, so we were in some ways, you know, that you often talk in social science of sort of inductive or deductive approaches, and this wasn't obviously fully inductive because, you know, both at a large scale level we had found evidence of this class pay gap, but then also before we started the interviews we knew the makeup of these firms.
Yeah.
So at some level I suppose we were interested in understanding the mechanisms that would explain that. But I think even then, the results did confound us in some way. I think particularly the thing that we were surprised about is that we often hear about networks as being important. There's often this sort of notion of networking, and it's often sort of premised on this notion of quite sort of fleeting, an ability to sort of constantly be on the lookout for making instrumental connections with whole ranges of people, and that's a really powerful way that you understand who gets to the top. And I think one of the things we were quite surprised about was that actually, although, you know, that was an important part of people's trajectories to some extent, actually understanding the precise way in which people had got to the top and how they narrated that, which perhaps isn't talked about in everyday life, was normally two or three really key individuals who had played this sort of sponsorship role, but, you know, behind the scenes to some extent. And so it was, I think that there were definitely elements that we were surprised about in terms of what we were finding.
Yeah. I mean, were you shocked or surprised at the intensity, particularly of your working class respondents' descriptions of the injustices that they experience, you know, whether subliminally or explicitly, especially in places like Channel 4.
You know what's really interesting about that is I think there's such variation in that. So, I mean, you know, it really isn't the case that in these instances, everyone who from working class or sort of lower middle class backgrounds actually feels that in these occupations, even when they're subject to these barriers.
Yeah.
I think that they're often, and in some ways this is the sadder point, is that they, as we all are, have sort of swallowed the rhetoric that someone like Theresa May has put forward and is more generally pervasive about our trajectories being the result of our own meritocratic abilities and hard work. And therefore, I think a lot of the time people are sort of explaining their trajectories through notions of their own deficit or their own their own lack of skills. And so in a way, you did get examples of people who did feel much more acutely like they had barriers put forward or were able to sort of identify things about others that they, you know, felt were unfair. And there were, of course, instances where much more sort of, I suppose, overt class discrimination was felt. You know, among the actors, for example, there was a lot of talk about sort of the fairly pernicious way that they were typecast. And, you know, this was particularly the case for women from working class backgrounds where, you know, they would talk about how, you know, the sorts of roles they are cast into are not just incredibly restrictive and tend to be secondary and therefore less well paid, but also just the actual representations, you know, of the battered mum, you know, the single mother, sort of all these sort of caricatures that they didn't feel in any way matched their actual social experience. So it's a sort of dual area in which those things. So I think you got a real continuum between people who really felt it.
Yeah.
And people who actually had sort of in some way blamed themselves.
Yeah, yeah. In the book, you talk to an actor from a working class background who decides to actually drop out of acting altogether because it just becomes too difficult for him to sustain a living. And again, he gets absolutely fed up by the typecasting, has just left a soap, not under circumstances of his own choosing. But the quote that absolutely sticks with me from his interview that you include in the book is, well, it's middle-class people making programmes for working-class people in the end, isn't it? And what he's actually talking about is extremely middle-class, upper-middle-class people like Mark, the commissioner at Channel 4, who sort of says, yeah, I've got this strong wind of privilege following me. And yeah, it's another great quote from the book is, well, it's not Hegel, it's just telling, isn't it? Something like that. Therefore, they're thereby exposing the cultural references kind of needed to get by in that situation, and yet the hoarding of the knowledge that means, well, I've got all this knowledge, but I'm not going to translate it into decent programming for the people who I perceive are watching my programmes.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I think, you know, there's a for somewhere like Channel 4, there's a sort of double imperative here in relation to why this stuff matters, because, of course, they're on the front line of producing the culture that we all consume, which is obviously really powerful in terms of representations of class, race, gender. And I think, you know, there's a clear sense in which, you know, if you're making hard-hitting drama or documentaries about communities that nobody in the commissioning room has got any real understanding of, then is it really a surprise that we get genres like poverty porn that just seem to betray a real misunderstanding of how many people in this country actually live?
So I mean, that kind of active, or, you know, well, kind of willful neglect or active misunderstanding of how people live is kind of, it's buoyed by the political narrative of the last several decades that, as you mentioned before, suggests that social mobility for individuals is kind of A, desirable, and B, seamless.
Yeah.
That, you know, just go to school, work hard enough, you'll do great. Then you can get then you too can get to make poverty porn on Channel 4. But I think what you really get to the heart of the book, and I wanted to ask you if this was your intention,
is
whether you wanted to bring to light the fact that while individual social mobility is evidently not a myth, because you find plenty of socially mobile people to talk to working in elite occupations, the fact of meritocracy, as is propagated by government, right up to and including Theresa May, is an absolute myth.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really hard one, because I think it, there's a question that all organisations and professions have to face about how they, on what grounds they progress people, and on what grounds people move forward in their careers. And I think in some ways there you've got one notion of people striving to make sure that the grounds on which that happens is the fairest way possible. And then at the same time we've got this narrative of a sort of meta-narrative that I think, most of the survey work shows you is incredibly powerful in terms of the beliefs of most of the general population, not just in this country but across the Western world, that actually, if you do work hard, then, and you are talented, then you will reach the top. And I think, from my view, in a way, is just that whilst I'm ambivalent, and I think I understand, and especially having worked with organisations here, about not just being the sort of prototypical academic critiquing from background about the fact that they need to operate in a way that involves, in a routine way, progression and promotion, and what ground should they do it on. But at the same time, this sense that, a puncturing through data and through robust research, people's sort of incredibly strongly held belief that the country as a whole is operating in a meritocratic way. Mm-hmm. So I think, I don't know if that answers the question, I think that's sort of how I would see it, in a way. So it's a sort of, in some ways, still some sort of desire to need to keep hold of some idea of a fair understanding of merit that is then the basis on which people progress in various ways.
Yeah.
But at the same time, a sort of meta critique of meritocracy as a sort of overarching way of thinking about society.
Yeah. But again, one of the constant threads through the book is this kind of what I've termed in my notes as the three C's, which is that the parental occupation is of absolutely primary significance, because it provides the kind of the safe base upon which people can achieve further social and economic mobility. Mm. And that's connections, confidence and cash. And which of those three do you think is the the most important?
So interesting, isn't it? I would say that, again, one that I think, it's really hard not to come down on cash. But I think, what we find in the book is that it's a little bit uneven. So if you look at the cultural and creative industries, as I mentioned, there is the way in which sort of parental wealth is constantly in the background of people's narratives. And it's an interesting question about the fact that it's, and even many of those people would admit to us in interviews, downplayed and an uncomfortable topic to actually recognise and talk about, even with your own friends, about, to what extent, your lifestyle and your career choice is facilitated by your parents' ability to support you in periods when you're out of work, to allow you to live in this city and buy property and all of those sorts of things. I mean, I think probably having said that, I'm particularly fascinated by this notion of confidence, which, is what most people, when at the end of every interview, we gave people this sort of this basic finding of the class pay gap, and we said, what do you think is driving this? And the vast majority of people, the first word they hit upon was confidence. But I think from our point of view, there's a danger that we sort of individualise or essentialise confidence as a sort of personality trait, and we don't see how it's sort of patterned and contextual. And so I think what we're trying to do in the book is sort of show that actually, you know, many of the people from working class backgrounds that we talk to would say, you know, there's loads of contexts in life where I feel hugely confident, where I feel like I'm supported and valued and my place in the world is secure. But it's not in many of these workplace settings. And that, so rather than seeing confidence as an intrinsic element that is sort of passed down through different class backgrounds, it's often about providing sort of the tools culturally that allow you to fit in, and then once you fit in, there's a sense of being emboldened or inhibited, depending on how you feel, that then has a really big impact on how you appear to others, which is often read by gatekeepers and all of us as confidence. But I think we would want to wrestle back that confidence is very often context specific.
But this is it. I mean, confidence fundamentally is about safety, isn't it? A sense of personal sort of interior safety. And this is where government action or willful neglect comes in, really, because if we create a society that is fundamentally economically unsafe for a lot of people, then people will feel unsafe in all sorts. You will permanently be feeling like you're skydiving without a parachute, as one of the actors said.
And I think, you know, I think economic inequality sort of looms in the background with in the book in some ways, particularly around this stuff, which I think, you know, your work has touched on as well, Lindsay, about the sort of experience of upward social mobility and the fact that, you know, that to some extent, the longer the journey and the more precipitous that journey is, which of course is a question about inequality ultimately, it's often then that the sort of sense of how that affects your sense of safety in terms of identity and sort of psychosocial wellness is accentuated when that journey is greater and there's more sort of cultural dislocation that takes place from having to traverse those worlds. So I, you know, for me, it's although we don't sort of, I suppose, address that head on, it's there in the background.
Well, one thing that you do address head on right at the end of the book is you and your co-author Daniel Laurison actually come up with 10 points that workplaces can work towards to make their workplaces to become more socially mobile friendly employers, for want of a better word, to become more socially equal employers. Do you want to run through a few of those points?
I mean, I think the first one is really about it's kind of a bit dull, but it's about, but I think it's crucial, is about data basically, and about the fact that, you know, in most workplaces, and partly a result of the fact that class is not a protected characteristic, most organisations up until this point haven't been measuring and monitoring the class or socioeconomic backgrounds of their staff. And I suppose we feel like we have provided, both through the case studies and through some of the work that I've done with people like the Social Mobility Commission, a way in which that can actually be done and be rolled out really across different sectors in a very straightforward way. And then once you understand really what organisations look like, there's always a better understanding of how to affect change, because you know that at Channel 4 the issue is particularly in the commissioning department and things like that. There's also a sense here of the importance of intersectionality, and again, you know, you often see organisationally that diversity is sort of seen in these singular ways. You know, we talk about, you know, race and ethnicity, then we talk about gender, then we talk about social mobility, and I think what we see very clearly in our data is the intersections between those categories and how there's a very distinct experience in lots of organisations for, you know, black women from working class backgrounds, etc. So, and for organisations, again, they have the ability often, particularly big organisations, to see those intersections in their data and then understand what to, how you can support those people in particular ways. I think the hardest thing in a way is this question about culture, occupational culture, and how it facilitates or emboldens some and inhibits others. You know, and just to talk about Channel 4 for a while, I'm aware we've been complicit in sort of bashing them here, but actually the project's been fantastic with them because I think they've been very brave and they really are attempting to tackle this in an interesting ways. And one of the things that we're trying to do with them is to sort of initiate a conversation within the channel about what talent and merit actually looks like, but in a way that isn't dry and academic and is actually a little bit more appropriate to the firm and the industry they're in. And so, for instance, you know, we talked about this concept of studied informality and the behavioural code that is fairly arbitrary but really important for understanding who fits in Channel 4. And their idea to sort of facilitate a conversation about around that is to sort of create a video or that basically sends up their own culture and then use that as a tool to start a conversation within the firm about, you know, how can we address some of the contestation about what people at the top think is a good commissioner versus what many of the other people said to me in anonymous interviews is actually going on. So I think you sort of have to think innovatively about how you tackle the occupational culture point. But in some way, I think that is really key.
Yeah. So I mean, ultimately, if there are, say, Channel 4 reach a situation where, you know, 90% of its commissioners are state educated and come from, you know, sort of, you know, the least well-off 60%, yeah, rather than the top 20% or whatever. Do you think that will inherently change the culture in there and so it won't become this ridiculous sort of, cultural reference dropping gladiators match that commissioning meetings seem to be?
I mean, I don't know for sure, but my all indications from the research would be yes, because it is those at the top who are largely setting the agenda in terms of what's valued, because they're often in the gatekeeping positions, mm-hmm, to actually decide.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, that once you change that composition, and there is one of the firms that I didn't talk about, the architecture practice, where, mm-hmm, it is fairly diverse at the top. It's very male dominated, and that's another aside, but there is a sense that that because of the composition at the top, there is a very different set of things which are valued inside that practice, and what therefore trickles down to what the early career staff in that firm look up to or think is what they need to do to get to the top. And, you know, so I do think that will make a difference. It's just very hard to think about how you force through that change, because, of course, if you think about things like quotas and affirmative action, the problem with that, even if we may agree on it as a socially just approach, is that it very often backfires. And then if you lose the hearts and minds of the middle managers who are actually sort of integral to sort of the way an organisation operates, then they just circumvent these sorts of processes anyway, and the whole thing sort of falls apart. So, you know, interestingly, somewhere like Channel 4, where I think despite the fact that there's such a widespread problem, there's actually huge buy-in to redressing the problem. And I think that in some ways is a more fertile environment. I'd say the accountancy firm, you know, much more ambivalence around how big a problem this is and whether they really need to change.
Right. Possibly because it's all to do with cash.
Well, maybe, yeah. And one of the things that they would say, which is a tough thing here, is they would say, you know, well, our clients demand a certain type of person. Mm. It's not about us, it's about the other, it's about, you know, expectations, and that, you know, self-presentation and corporate polish are things that, you know, that we need in order to make money. And I think, you know, I mean, what we said back to them is, how do you know that? I think you're right, there is a sort of a commercial imperative that they would fold this into as to why this is not top of their agenda.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Sam. I've got, we've got about 10 to 15 minutes for some questions now, if anybody'd like to ask. I'll take them one at a time, and there's somebody on either side with microphones, if you just want to hang on for a microphone. Okay, so we'll take you first and then you.
Thank you. My question is, aren't we dealing with a fundamental either conundrum or contradiction, which is no matter how much information and data, even in big organisations, is shared about diversity and the benefits of diverse teams, to promote different thinking and everything. The fundamental issue is whether it's at recruitment stage or team building stage, we still default to people like me. You know, the person who is recruiting, the person who is managing a team or recommending for promotion or whatever, still cannot, from a very human point of view, get beyond this is what it should look like to be successful. And therefore, you have already an inherent human bias, which is ironic when you still are confronted with data that says diversity is actually a better way to go.
Yeah, and that's so much about what the book is about. Yeah. But there's an interesting case study in the architect's firm, as Sam just mentioned. The architect's firm is the head, is it the head partner or one of the partners is a white male from a working class background. And he specifically identifies for that sort of, kind of raising up process of sort of befriending a junior architect assistant to try and get him up to be partner, picks somebody else from like me. Not in all ways. Because the man he picks for that, yeah, he is a man from a working class background of South Asian heritage, but really, really identified in him. Oh, he's working classes like me. Yeah.
In some ways, you've touched on it very acutely there. I mean, you talk about, in sociology, we have this term cultural matching that sort of goes on in these key sort of gatekeeping settings like interviews. And I think we see that throughout the book. And just to echo Lindsay's point, that there's not something conspiratorial about coming from a privileged background that means that it's only these sorts of people that do it. As we find in this other firm, that, you know, I think around this notion of misrecognizing as talent things that are often about the intrinsic elements of yourself, I think is probably something that everybody does. It just happens to be that the historical residue of a very profound class system has meant that our professions are still skewed towards men from white men from privileged backgrounds, so that's how it continues to play out. You know, I think one sort of fairly dull thing that you can do, but it's kind of crucial, but it won't solve this problem, is that there is still a lot of informality that is given legitimate weight in these sorts of settings that could be formalised in order to mitigate. If I just think about how I got my job at the LSE, perhaps I shouldn't even say this, but you can probably tell I'm from a fairly privileged background. And at the LSE, when you get your job, you actually you have to meet everybody in the department for a one-on-one chat. There's no sense of what you're supposed to talk about. And eventually, everyone in the department votes on the person they want. And I mean, I talk about this a little bit in the book, but I think there's no doubt in my mind that just an instinctive sense of like what the rules of the game are in those settings advantaged me. My dad is an academic, in a way that's just incredibly unfair, and just sort of ramping up the possibility of the stuff you're talking about coming to the fore. I think you're never going to stop it, but you can do things bureaucratically that probably mitigate it or accentuate it.
And then you.
Were all the people you interviewed, were they British born and long, generations back British? Were they immigrants? As an immigrant myself, when you start off with the idea of meritocracy, it's not obvious to me if you ask people around the world what it is about, what makes British culture special, that meritocracy would be the answer. I wondered how much you thought that was the assumption and how much people coming from maybe first generation, even privileged backgrounds overseas, experienced some of the challenges that you maybe described with people who were from working or other backgrounds here.
So just to recap, you were saying that your assumption coming into the UK was that we are a meritocratic society.
No.
Oh, that we're not. Right. Yes, I mean, I think, just to directly answer your question, there were, particularly in the architecture practice, not in the main labour force survey data, okay, that's British born, or the people that aren't British born, we took out of the analysis. But obviously at these three firms, there were a number of people. I think what I would say is that they were never enough people to be able to sort of do meaningful analysis. Do you see what I mean? I think there's a sort of, there's perhaps a sense that you are less classed, weirdly, if you are not from the UK, even if you are clearly coming from a classed location in your own country. The markers that are read around accent, self-presentation that are quite nationally specific in the UK are such that you are perhaps not as marked in that way on either end. But of course, that would depend on the particular country you're coming from. You know, the Commonwealth countries where elements of the British class system are probably still play a role in those national cultures, that would change. But I'm somewhat speculating here because it wasn't a meaningful part of the analysis, but I think it's a really interesting question. Thank you.
Yes, lady in the front.
I just wondered whether you've had any historical data about whether social mobility has improved or regressed. When I was studying sociology years ago, they used to say that in the 1960s, social mobility had improved.
Yeah, it's a really good question. So there's a lot to say here, and I'll try and say it in a... I'll try and say it without boring you all senseless. So there's big debates, and there's a lot of research and researchers who look specifically at this question. It tends to be organised into two camps. The sociologists that measure occupational mobility, to what extent your parents' occupation relates to your occupation, and their measurement within socioeconomic classes. Those people tend to argue that actually social mobility has stayed fairly constant over time. And that the narrative of increased post-war mobility is an artifact of the changing nature of the occupational structure. We had a huge expansion of professional and managerial jobs. There was more room at the top, and therefore lots of children of working class backgrounds rose to fill those jobs in the post-war period. But if you just look at the relative chances in those periods of anyone from privileged background versus a working class background entering those jobs, the actual odds stayed the same. So it was a slight sort of, people felt and saw increases in absolute upward social mobility. They saw their colleagues changing a little bit, but actually in terms of relative chances, it stayed the same. At the moment, there's a debate among economists who study income mobility, who argue that social mobility in the UK measured along those lines in terms of how your earnings are relate to your parents' earnings, that social mobility has gone down. So it's either stagnated or it's gone down. So not particularly great. Personally, I've looked got some really interesting data from Who's Who, which is a sort of catalogue of the British elite that's been published for the last 120 years, which we were able to get the entire historical database of. And one of the interesting things that we looked at in there was the power, the propulsive power of Britain's very elite private schools. So we're specifically interested in the Clarendon schools, so that's Eton, Harrow, Westminster, St Paul's, etc. And we've written about how in that context you see a really interesting, you do see some decline in the ability of those old boys to reach Who's Who, i.e. to reach the very top of British society over time. But that decline is in the context of persistence that is incredibly powerful still. So if you, just to give you a stat, if you go to one of those Clarendon schools today, you're 94 times more likely to reach the British elite than if you go to any other type of school. And that, just to put that stat in some sort of context, John Goldthorpe, who's sort of seen as the godfather of social mobility in the UK, once said if there were odds ratios above 5 or 6, that's a sign of extreme inequality in opportunity. So, you know, you get some context of what power those schools still have in propelling.
Yeah, 94 is off the dial, basically, yeah. All crumbs. Okay. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So we've got 5 minutes, but can I try and take everybody's question, but can you try and keep it keep it little. Is that all right? So you first, and then 1, 2, 3, yeah.
When you look at the working class, the few working class people who actually made it to the top,
yeah,
were there typical or common attributes that they tended to have?
Mm. Okay, and then, yeah.
Do you think private schools should be abolished?
That's an easy one.
And then you at the back, you behind, and then you. Yeah.
You've touched on this already, but did you find essentially class trumped things like other things that could be seen as disadvantages, like race, for example, in British-born people within the companies that you looked at?
And
I used to run an independent school, so I'm very interested in your answer to the second question. I just wanted to ask you if you, in your research, try and unpick the notion of privilege at all. I'm thinking, for example, of E.M. Forst, who said the products of public schools left with well-developed bodies, fairly developed minds, and undeveloped hearts. Does that play at all on this issue?
Do you think you can succinctly answer that group of questions?
Common attributes of people who've got to the top from working-class backgrounds. Some sense the experience had been fairly exhausting. Other than that, lots of people ask about this, and there's lots of research in psychology that's tried to get at this. I don't think I really did, actually. I think they were quite diverse. And so, you know, some research that sort of talks about needing to be quite dogged and quite determined and almost kind of pushy to have overcome the barriers. Interestingly, I've just done a documentary with BBC Two on this, which was presented by the media editor, who I've now temporarily forgotten his name. It will come back to me. But anyway, they do a test in the program about degrees of extroversion, and he's been incredibly upwardly mobile, and he comes out like top. And so I'm not sure I necessarily saw this, but I'm saying confidence is context specific, and any psychologist would probably say, okay, yeah, to an extent, but there's also these traits, and extroversion is something that's perhaps independent of sociology at some level, and maybe there's something there about extroversion that propels people above and beyond these barriers. Yes, private schools should be abolished. Apologies. I'm currently on the Social Mobility Commission. We've had some discussions about this. I'm amazed at how little the appetite for this, for any question of reform around private schools is. Just on the very basis of the link they have in terms of the reproduction of privilege in this country, I think it's a pretty open and shut case for me. But I see that it's very easy just to say yes. The actual notion of how that would take place and just the incredible emotion that it tends to invoke in people on either side is going to make it a pretty tortured thing. But I'd like to start the conversation about it. I'd like the Social Mobility Commission to start the conversation about at least reform in a meaningful way or taxation in a meaningful way. My commissioners don't agree with me. Does class trump race? No, I don't think so. I think the point that we're really trying to underline is that we have multiple axes of our identity, and that they often act together to create intersecting elements of who we are. And so I don't really see a meaningful way of really being able to determine what trumps what. And I just wouldn't frame it in that way. And I think in our data, you see the sort of intersections rather than notions of one doing more. And it's very hard to pull apart anyway. What does privilege mean? It's a big and really interesting question. I'm not even sure where to start, but I think one of the only interesting things maybe to say back to that is that we do have this interesting narrative in the UK that many more people identify as being subjectively from a working class background than objectively when we look at their actual backgrounds. And so despite a very strong class system and a sort of obsession with privilege and the royal family and private schooling, whatever, there's also, I think, an interesting romance around upward mobility, which means that very often in interviews, people want to tell an upward story. And one of the interesting things that they tend to do, and I think that's something about downplaying or offsetting notions of privilege that people feel uncomfortable about. And one of the interesting things that a lot of people do is they don't, when you ask them about their background, they don't tell you about their background, they tell you about their parents' background. And that's meaningful into the extent to which a lot of us grew up hearing about our parents' trajectory, and that then informs how we think about ourselves. But it's often also a thing of saying, well, it's sort of slightly downplaying the fact that often those parents were upwardly mobile, and that, what that really means is that you grew up in a middle-class house, even if your parents still held onto a working-class identity. And so I think there's lots of interesting questions about how people think about privilege in their identities. Yeah.
Well, all we know about privilege is that it pays to be privileged. But thank you, Sam. Can you please give Sam a round of applause?
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.